Welcome back. I'm talking to Mary Robinson. At this stage, you're still UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and you've agreed an extra year. And this is when that began, actually, from 9/11. And there was, of course, a huge change. The American administration now, President Bush.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
How did the whole phenomenon of 9/11 impact on the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights?
Well, first of all, it impacted hugely on the United States, which up to then had felt invulnerable. You know, there were huge terrorist attacks elsewhere in London, in Dublin, in Cairo, in wherever, Bali. And they were very shocked and traumatized. And I remember going to Ground Zero, meeting the families, and then realizing in my office that we had to get our message out very quickly, that these were crimes against humanity and that the role was to go against the perpetrators, and Al-Qaeda had admitted. So even going militarily into Afghanistan, if it was to get the Al-Qaeda, that was legitimate to counter a crime against humanity. But what I was hearing from the Bush administration is this is a war on terror. War on terrorism, and all options are open. And they became not only ambivalent on torture, they tortured. They exported people for torture in other countries, extrajudicial. They were not at all supportive of the work that we were trying to do in promoting that we needed to treat these as crimes against humanity and go the criminal route.
And they never really wanted you to, in your office, to consider America as part of your agenda, that they might also be offenders against human rights.
That was always a problem. I tell, in fact, a story earlier of Madeleine Albright, who came to the Commission on Human Rights because she was supportive of the work of the Commission. It was great that she came. But in a meeting with me, when I raised with her the fact that the United States hasn't ratified the covenant and important conventions on economic and social rights, and also that the death penalty in the United States was being used very freely, including against those who committed the crime under 18 and who didn't have consular attention. And she bridled a bit at that. And when we walked out afterwards, we were friends. She said, "Mary, you know, don't mind about the United States." But I knew as High Commissioner that it was incredibly important for the balance of human rights that if the United States was not adhering to the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention Against Torture, and that's what happened after 9/11, that I had to speak out very firmly and unequivocally and hold the United States to account.
And what circumstances then were you willing to stay on, and did Kofi Annan not support you in that?
What I was finding was that I was getting reports from the rapporteurs all around the world, human rights defenders all around the world, that the situation had a knock-on effect on countries that didn't have the democratic checks and balances of the United States. They were clamping down on freedom of the press. They were using a new language for opposition. They were terrorists. And somehow the world was becoming grimmer from a human rights perspective. So I felt, and I talked to Nick about it, and he was reluctant, but he saw that I was very aware that this was extraordinarily serious and that I couldn't leave after a year if Kofi Annan would agree that I would do the full 4 years. In other words, another 3 years. And I spoke to Kofi Annan about this. I said to him, "I know that the United States is not happy with my criticism." And he said at that time, "The United States is only one country and leave it with me." But he never actually came back to me directly. But I learned that he was going to appoint his very good friend, Sergio Vieira de Mello, whom I had known and liked very much for his work in East Timor and in Kosovo. A wonderful field humanitarian person. And ultimately, I supported Sergio. We did a great handover of the office. And the office, of course, was much stronger at that stage. And I think had moral influence because we were speaking out, both about the problems with the United States, but also globally post 9/11.
Did you feel let down then by Kofi Annan?
I did in the short term. But again, Nick was quick to say to me, "Look, you tried and it's not your fault. Now let's get on with an easier life," because it was taking quite a toll. At the same time, I felt very positive about what we were doing in the office. And my final farewell in the office was an extraordinarily warm occasion. It was a party, if you like, and I got lovely messages and things. But I felt I've left this office much, much stronger with a real sense of purpose, with better resources in this fine Pally Wilson. And, you know, I can leave because whoever takes over, and Sergio de Mello not only took over, but unfortunately was killed in Baghdad only about a year later.
And did you know then what you wanted to do next?
I wanted to put more emphasis on economic and social rights, meaning rights to food and safe water and health and education, and to do it in the United States. Because part of the agenda would be to continue to speak out, not with any mandate as High Commissioner, but just as a human rights person, about the need for the United States to get back to understanding that torture is not acceptable, that you fight terrorism by standing up for your values of democracy and human rights, and you get the world to come with you to bring perpetrators to justice. So for 8 years, based out of New York with colleagues in Washington and in Geneva, we worked on economic and social rights and promoted African countries' issues, health and decent work issues. But I also spoke out during that time about the need to fight terrorism with our values and be very clear that otherwise we were going to see a sort of undermining of those values and a hatred of the West for double standards.
And in what circumstances then did you become interested in climate as a key issue in all of this, climate change and climate justice?
It became clear to me in my many visits to African countries on health issues, on women, peace and security issues, that the conversation was changing. It was but things are so much worse. We have prolonged drought now and flash flooding. Our food security is undermined. And I realised that this was an issue of justice and human rights, a huge issue of justice and human rights. I also had never intended to spend longer than about 5 years. In the end, it was 8 years promoting this piloting of economic and social rights. So I was preparing to come back to Ireland. And it seemed to me this was the ideal issue. Ireland has such a good reputation of tackling hunger and of understanding developing countries and their real issues, and that I could have some kind of entity in Ireland to work on that. And that's what I was working towards the end of during 2010.
And it is a cross-cutting issue, isn't it? Climate justice.
It's very much a cross-cutting issue because it raises all the issues. We're going to see increasing displacement of people, so-called climate refugees. It's predicted there could be as many as 200 million climate refugees. There is no regime of how this will work out. Because of more food insecurity and water shortage, we may see wars about water and food. And so this really brings together the whole issue. But also the interdependence of the world, the rich parts of the world, including Ireland in this context, Ireland, Europe, the United States, Korea, Japan, etc., have become more prosperous because of fossil fuel, oil and gas and coal. And therefore, there was a need to remind that our prosperity has worsened the poor life chances of the poorest, and that we need to address that. And so I established the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice in Dublin, linked to both Trinity and UCD in the Alliance of Innovation. And we're now in a very global challenge. We have forged a memorandum of understanding with the World Resources Institute based in Washington, which is a very big organisation, to promote over the next couple of years a climate justice dialogue and to somehow get a new narrative about climate, which puts people in the centre. What is the impact it's having and what can we do about it? We need to increase mitigation, but we also need to bring fairness and equity into how countries are adapting. When I was in Malawi at the beginning of January, I saw that instead of just having normal planting and food security, Malawi now has to have different seeds. It has shorter seasons. It has to have flesh-coloured sweet potatoes because they will grow and give nourishment in a way that wasn't the case before, wasn't needed before. And so it's that bit harder for poor countries. And then there are so many people who don't have access to electricity. 1.4 billion people. We have the gadgets now, off-grid lights and clean cook stoves. And so I found it very exciting with my colleagues that we can work on these issues.
But the scale of them is absolutely enormous, isn't it?
It is in one way, but I think there is a recognition that we're in a very pivotal time up to 2015. We're going to be talking about these Millennium Development Goals and what comes afterwards, the goals that are to tackle poverty and promote education and healthcare, etc. But we're also, we have a promise of governments that we will have a climate agreement by 2015. We won't get that unless we talk about equity and fairness. So what we're doing is reaching out to networks of networks to create, and we're using a language which may be strange to talk about, to create constituencies of demand for a fair climate agreement and for more understanding of the injustice of how climate is affecting poor peoples and poor communities in poor countries that are vulnerable.
But saying it is one thing. Convincing, I mean, if one looks at those countries who are doing the polluting and creating the climate change, they're not the ones who are suffering.
They're suffering more. I mean, the United States now realizes, because of drought in the Midwest and in particular Hurricane Sandy, that the weather shocks will be worse. The World Bank, under its new president, Jim Kim, is putting total priority on tackling climate change. It's the World Development Bank. And it knows that we will not have a safe world and safe development unless we address this. I speak often as a grandmother about this, to make it real to people how little time we have. My four grandchildren who are young will be in their 40s in 2050. The world at that stage may be much, much more difficult to live in. It's estimated we could have 200 million climate displaced people, many of them from Africa. Where will they go? That we may have more weather shocks, more drought, more flash flooding. We see in Australia, it's aggravated. Australia can cope, but Malawi can't cope when you've sudden aggravation because it doesn't have the resources. It just gets poorer. So, and these are countries where the population is growing. We're going to have 9 billion people in our world in 2050. It's not a scaremongering. It's more we need to do now what we can do to have a better framework for climate resilience, both in our own countries and in poorer countries. And that's actually could create jobs.
And coming to your own career and being a woman, looking back on it, are you gender blind on this matter? Do you just sail on and ignore that, or have you encountered the glass ceiling?
I'm very interested in women's leadership. And yes, there are various kinds of ceilings. I think personally, I haven't encountered them directly as much, but I'm very conscious of them. I'm also conscious that in the 21st century, we're going to see more women's leadership and it has to make more difference. We managed my foundation, the Mary Robinson Foundation Climate Justice, my colleagues and myself, we helped to shape a troika of women leaders because there were three women who presided over climate conferences. And in the last climate conference in Doha, we, together with UN Women and others, managed to get the principle of gender balance into the whole climate system. They call it the Doha miracle. And it means that in all of the UN bodies like the Green Climate Fund, there now has to be gender balance, which ultimately is 50-50, and in the delegations. So I'm interested in women's leadership. I'm interested in grassroots leadership, linking with those who are making a great difference at grassroots, but probably most of all in moral leadership, which is why being invited to join the Elders was, to me, such a highlight.
And the Elders then, the leadership here comes from Nelson Mandela. What is their function, and is it not a lot of people just chatting and meeting up regularly to tell the world how it ought to live?
Well, it was a complete surprise to me in May 2007 in my office in New York when I was approached by Richard Branson explaining that he and Peter Gabriel had convinced Nelson Mandela to bring together a group of elders, and they had had a lot of consultation and worldwide meetings, and my name had come up, so he was coming to tell me more about it and encourage me to come to a planning meeting in Africa, in South Africa. I was a bit sceptical. I thought, you know, what is this? But as soon as we met with Nelson Mandela and he sat at the table with us, with Jimmy Carter, with Muhammad Yunus, with his wife, Graça Machel, and under the chairmanship of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, whom I love them all, but particularly Arch, when we heard Mandela talk about what this group should do, all my scepticism vanished and it became a mandate for life.
And here is Archbishop Tutu and what he has to say about you.
She cares about poverty, she cares about injustice, she cares about oppression, because she she remembers so much of the history of her own people. She's got a way of disarming people. I love her.
He is a remarkable figure, isn't he? Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town.
I've learned so much from him. I've known him over the years, and he's somebody who understands how to use humour to get people to relax and then come in with the serious message. And I've seen him do that so often. And sometimes the message is just simply affirming, for example, with young people, their goodness and their potential. And you see their faces light up and they, you know. But I've also seen him when we were together in Côte d'Ivoire after the terrible fighting in Abidjan. I was there with Kofi Annan and Arch. And we visited a church where there were displaced people who had nothing, and not even enough food. And they were really down, and he spoke. And you could see how his voice and his caring literally lifted them. You know, they began to sit up, they began to laugh. And that's probably the first time they'd laughed since they were displaced. And it's a very little thing, but it's very important, that kind of sense of caring and reaching out and touching people.
And Nelson Mandela also speaks very highly of him.
But whatever techniques they use, I believe that in the end, it is kindness and generous accommodation that are the catalysts for real change. I know these esteemed friends of mine are capable of doing all these things. And I expect that if my friend, the Archbishop, has anything to do with it, they will insist on assuming the essential interdependence of all humankind. We call this the spirit of Ubuntu, that profound African sense that we are human only through the humanity of other human beings.
That was at the launch of the Elders. Now, what have they achieved, in your opinion?
I believe that we have addressed some of the issues that other people try to avoid. North Korea, the need to open up dialogue there. In the context of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, if we're going to have two states, then we must talk to Hamas. We must get Hamas to link with Fatah and become stronger for the Palestinians. And the Elders supported the Palestinians going to the General Assembly and getting that extra recognition of their state. We have helped to focus on some broad issues of the inequality of women and girls in so many parts of the world. And that brought us to a very practical issue of early child marriage. And because of the Elders' involvement, there is now a very effective global partnership called Girls Not Brides, which is helping to address the problem where 10 million girls in the world are married far before they're ready for it physically, psychologically. And it causes terrible problems of child mortality, maternal mortality, etc. And that's an issue that people had avoided because it was difficult. It was marriage and it was a local tradition. We were in Ethiopia, in the Amhara region, and Archbishop Tutu was leading us, and also in Egypt with Archbishop Tutu and Ila Bat, another wonderful elder, and Gru Brundtland. And we saw that the average marriage age in the countryside was 12. There were girls married younger than 12. That was the average. And we were there because there were people working on that in the villages. And our support has augmented greatly what they're doing. But it's also linked with this Girls Not Bride partnership. We are also aware that individual elders take on huge burdens. Kofi Annan first, and now Lakhdar Brahimi is, you know, waking up every morning with the issues in Syria, and he keeps in touch with us, and we've been supporting him, and perhaps the elders will get more involved there. We're also, you know, aware that the situation in Mali and that whole post-Libya situation is going to mean that there would be more demands on us. And it's that discussion of issues that are very difficult to grapple with that I think the elders can play a continuing role in.
And educating young women, educating girls, is, of course, a very important part, isn't it, of changing in all of these agendas that you're interested in.
Very much so. It's good that development experts worldwide now understand, educate the girl and the woman, and you will change that community and that country. And I must say, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State of the United States, has played a big role by constantly repeating that from her position. And it reinforces, the World Bank had a report last year on gender equality. And I think in this century, it is going to be one of the ways in which we will make real change by focusing on the importance of the girl child, of educating girls and women, and of having gender parity, gender balance in all the decision-making organs. That's good for humanity as a whole.
And that, did that prompt you to some extent to write this memoir?
Yes, I think I wanted, as part of giving back, essentially, to share the experience that I've had. Ila Batt said to me, and I quote that in the top of the last chapter, you know, that our experience is not just our own personal property, that it must be shared. And I really felt that, partly, I think, to encourage young people, but really to encourage everyone. How could I possibly have known, growing up in Mayo with these four brothers, where my life would lead me? And I have had the privilege of working in extraordinary contexts, and that continues to be the case. I'm very engaged now with my colleagues in climate justice. I believe that it's good to do that out of Ireland and have that sense that Ireland is contributing. We're about to have a major conference in Dublin on hunger, nutrition, climate justice during Ireland's presidency of the EU. And it will be a conference that will listen to examples at grassroots. I don't think any other country would have a conference quite like that. And so the ability to continue to contribute, but also to share my experience, was very much the motivation. My greatest joy with the book was doing it with my daughter, Tessa. And to the extent that it's readable, Tessa gets the credit.
How difficult is it to write about your own career without sounding self-serving?
I think it helped greatly to do it with Tessa, because she was part of it for a long time. For example, I probably wouldn't have been as frank about how much of a toll the first few months of High Commissioner took. And she said to me, remember, Mom, you wouldn't even talk to us when you came home at Christmas. You were completely, you know, upset and not yourself. And you must tell that. People must understand. And there were, you know, a number of times where she helped me to be as honest as you can be, you know. And I did want to bring out the human dimension. I wanted to help women in particular with that work-life balance problem, you know, how to also, you know, have a family life. And when I was talking about that recently, a friend of mine said something quite amusing. You know, why is it that women always talk about work-life balance? We need more men to think about work-life balance, which I thought was a good comment. But it isn't always easy for women to balance achieving, you know, breakthroughs in a career and try to also be very close to family.
And what has the cost been in your case, do you think?
I just think I've been very fortunate in my life. The greatest honour was to be nominated for and to be elected President of Ireland. And that campaign changed me. It opened me up. It brought out in me more of the traits of my mother. I know that. And I'm grateful for that, because I never really went back. And that, I think each stage of my life has been a case of sort of building a little bit on the earlier stages, because being president was an exercise of moral authority. It's a non-executive role. And then being High Commissioner for Human Rights in many ways also was a bully pulpit and moral authority, no big stick, but having to face truth to power in particular. And now, in the combination of an elder with being president of this wonderful small team, with Tara Shine, an expert on climate, educating me, is a kind of continuation of grappling with the big issues, but now, thankfully, doing it from Ireland with a sense of pride in that. And Ballina has decided to develop in my family home a Mary Robinson Centre. That's another kind of give back, which I'm very happy with, and very happy that it's linked with University College Galway, which has a huge reputation for its Centre for Human Rights and its Centre for Women's Leadership. So I like the idea of strengthening institutions like the presidency and the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights, and then having some permanent way of continuing with issues, because individuals pass on, but having some continuity is important.
And growing up as a girl, you couldn't have seen any of this, of course, but you were somebody who, when you were a student, decided, though you didn't think you were a good debater or you weren't going to be necessarily a very good barrister because you didn't have confidence in public speaking, you went up to the LNH and UCD, even though you're a Trinity student, just to practice, as it were, to put yourself through that test.
That's right. And I wanted to, you know, to tell that very clearly in the book, because there are a lot of girls in particular who feel shy and who maybe don't quite feel the confidence to push themselves. And confidence is important. So I was trying to encourage those who, like me, would have felt shy and a bit diffident to have the courage to just go that step further. That was very much part of my thinking, because boys instinctively, I think, have more confidence in their ability. Girls need to be encouraged more and mentored more. And so part of it is to do that.
And the presidential campaign was a further example of that.
Yes, I think it was, for me, important to make it clear from the beginning that being a woman as president was a plus, you know, something extra. It allowed me to draw on qualities of nurturing, problem solving, accessibility, reaching out, creating new spaces, doing it differently because I was a woman. And I think that's important in women's leadership. I do feel at the moment that we don't have enough examples of really creative women's leadership, but I'm seeing it coming. And part of it is linking women who have access to real power in their countries or in their international institutions with those women who are leading in their communities, coping with poverty, with climate justice, climate change, with other things, and making sure that that story is told. And I'm seeing that more and more now, and I'm seeing women talking about leadership in a very creative way, and an innovative way, which I like.
And the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice, that will obviously, that's something that you believe will be there when you're gone.
Yes, indeed. And I hope to model myself on Jimmy Carter so that I'll be here for a long time and, and can continue the work.
But you conclude the book by saying you've decided where you'll be buried.
Well, that's just because we are lucky enough to live close to one of the most beautiful graveyards, Adar Gul, near our village of Lahardon. And I told the story because I think it's a story of how we cherish memory in Ireland, of the fact that Lahardon is the Titanic village of Ireland, lost so many, 14 who went and 11 were killed on the Titanic. And they were young people. And that pageant, which played last year, showing that, was to me part of being home. Part of feeling very much at home in Mayo in particular, and in the surrounds that are very beautiful where we have our home, where we live in Massbrook. I don't get down there as often as Nick does, but every time I'm there and every time I walk the grounds and the lake, I feel deeply appreciative, and I feel a kind of spiritual homecoming.
Mary Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was the final programme in our four-part series of interviews with Mary Robinson. Since this last programme was recorded, Mary Robinson has been appointed as a United Nations Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa. And her autobiography, Everybody Matters, is published by Hodder and Stoughton. And don't forget you can listen back to all four programmes in the series by following the link on the RTÉ Radio 1 website. Just follow the links for Mary Robinson talking to John Bowman. And now from me, thank you for listening.